Here are the three things that you need to know about today. Russia sends a signal, and it's not a soundbite. The U.S. media is outright lying to Americans. I saw this for myself firsthand. Let me tell you, it's worse than it's ever been before. Also, while Russian ships are seized on the high seas, the Kremlin's response is tepid, even apologetic, cordial. Why? This is the Sanchez effect. We're back. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and welcome to The Effect. I hope you're all rested and uplifted by spending time with your families. I had such a great time with my family, especially my granddaughter. Ugh, should I? Okay, just a little bit. Jean, go ahead, put this up if you can. Put the picture. There she is in Miami wearing her furry Russian hat, spending time with me, Papa, while I shared stories with her about Russia, about a little kind of bear thing called Chebi. It's a bear cartoon kind of Belarusian thing. She was fascinated by it. All right, enough of that. Okay, with the doting grandfather, I'm sorry. While I was home in Florida, though, I also got a chance to really take in the American media. And I have to tell you, it's worse than I thought. I saw up close and personal just how badly the people of my country, right, my friends, my family, are manipulated in what they see, in what they read, in what they hear. The media is now, more than ever, it seems, completely owned, if not directly run, by the state and by the special interests that control the state. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. When I turned on YouTube, not on my regular TV, but on my TV in a new home we just bought. Normally, I monitor YouTube through my own channel. So in my feed, it's set to a broad range of opinions. I follow everything. I follow the New York Times. I follow the BBC, Tucker Carlson, George Galloway, Indian networks, First Post, Chinese networks. But when I got to the United States and I opened the YouTube in our new home, and it hadn't been set up yet, I was just a new follower with a blank slate. I was like an average American viewer, right? Doesn't know. I was stunned by what they were pumping into my living room. For example, when it comes to the war in Ukraine, what predominates is a completely skewed bullcrap picture of reality. Look at these suggested YouTube offerings. I took photos of them with my phone while I was sitting on the couch, so you can see them yourself. Ukraine, right? Lands devastating blow in Crimea. Really? When did that happen? What blow? Here's another thumbnail. Screaming, Putin is naked. While the title then reads, Putin's defeat. Ukraine liquidates Kremlin's war machine. When? Here's another one. Moscow has been turned into hell. You see that? Didn't happen. I called. I could go on and on showing you these. They're all over the place. Each more ridiculous than the previous one, and nothing to balance it. But now look at this photo, and notice the sources underneath. I took this picture as well. Rachel Maddow. Really? That's the source? Rachel friggin' Maddow? Something called the U.S. Military Show. And then PBS. All of these are neocon globalist platforms or state-owned platforms, and all of them are deeply Russia-phobic. This is what state TV really looks like in America. It's what you're fed daily if you live there. And it's not just on the topic of Ukraine. You get this kind of stuff on China, the Middle East, India, and of course, Venezuela. Look, Americans aren't stupid, but they're fed a constant diet of stupid these days. What they don't get is journalism, real journalism, which is what we try to do for you here, for example. Because real journalism isn't about screaming headlines. It's not about thumbnails. It's about recognizing a pattern. So today I want to do that for you. I want to try and line up some of these stories that have occurred in the last couple of weeks and the first week of the year and try and offer up a conclusion of where we are now. Number one, first, the United States openly removes the president of a sovereign nation, Nicolas Maduro. Not through elections, not through the United Nations, but through pressure, through coercion, corruption, and force. In fact, let's call it what it is. kidnapping. But listen to how it's framed.
American companies will have the opportunity to rebuild Venezuela's rotting energy infrastructure and eventually increase oil production to levels never, ever seen before. When you add Venezuela and the United States together, we have 55% of the oil in the world. The United States is number one. We have them drilling. Drill, baby, drill was my campaign.
I'm from Latin America, so I can tell you that for more than 100 years, the United States has been plundering Latin America, scheming, stealing, killing. So this isn't new. It's not about Trump. What's new is this time, it seems unapologetically brazen. There's no legal framework. There's no declaration of war. Just we wanted it, so we took it. Here's the second act. The United States seizes a Russia-linked ship on the high seas. The ship is raided. The crews are detained. Property is stolen. Again, no war is declared, just a seizure, seemingly without consequence, or even the expectation that there will be a consequence. See, that's kind of getting scary. And talk about brazen. Third act. Reports emerge of a drone strike aimed at the residence of the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin. Call it an assassination attempt, call it whatever you wish. But understand this. That threat or those drones that may have been used, may have been launched, it probably was the Ukrainians that launched them. But the intelligence, the targeting, the guidance, that was supplied by American, British, German, and or French military advisors. Think about that for a minute. The West is involved in attacks on Russian soil. That matters a lot. And it matters even more when a military superpower's leader is targeted. This is a game changer. In fact, it's again one of those red lines that this guy has been warning about for years.
We often refuse to respond to unfriendly acts and openly low conduct. We really do not want to burn bridges, but if anyone misunderstands our good intentions as indifference or weakness and wants to intentionally burn or even blow up such bridges, they should know that our answer will be asymmetric, fast, and harsh. I hope that no one decides to cross a red line with Russia. We will decide on each matter individually to determine where those lines are.
Numero cuatro. Let's talk about the fourth act, right? It's something even more concrete. Suddenly, Ukrainian strikes target the Russian energy infrastructure, and they did it in a big way. It left Russians without power, heat, or water in the Belgorod region. That's large. You know how many people were left without any of that? Left in the dark by that attack? 550,000 people in the middle of winter, no less. And remember, we're talking about civilians here. So those things that I just took you through, they all happen. This is where this story breaks. Because you'd expect at this point, after what I just described, right, outrage, right, after something like that, escalation, retaliation, I guess. But what happens instead is restraint. Russia doesn't strike the U.S. Navy. It doesn't lash out diplomatically, even. In fact, Russia thanks the United States for returning its crew members from the ship that was seized. They actually thank them after seizing the ship.
In response to our appeal, U.S. President Donald Trump has decided to release two Russian citizens from the Marineris crew detained by the U.S. during an operation in the North Atlantic. We welcome this decision and express our gratitude to the U.S. leadership. We have begun to address urgently all issues related to ensuring the speedy return of our compatriots to their homeland.
Think about this for a moment. When most empires in history would already be firing, attacking, Russia again shows patience. The reaction is measured, even cordial. And by the way, I read some of the comments you sent to me while I was in Miami after I posted on this. Many of you asked, why is Russia being so calm? Why is there no immediate response? And you're right. The response was not immediate, And it wasn't delivered in words, because meaningful messages don't necessarily have to come from a podium. You know where it comes from? It comes from power. It comes from capability. It's not about what I say. It's about what I do or can do. And in the case of Russia's response, here is what they showed, what they did.
Several Ukrainian cities were hit in a night of intense Russian airstrikes. Russian military sources also confirmed they'd launched what they called a massive strike with a powerful hypersonic missile called Oryshnik against critical facilities in Ukraine.
We begin with Russia's most advanced weapon of war and its latest target. Russia launched a barrage of aerial attacks last night all across Ukraine. There were hundreds of drones and dozens of missiles. There was also the Russian military's new hypersonic Oryshnik missile.
The pictures that are emerging of the damage caused are quite extraordinary. Russia overnight has fired more than 200 drones and dozens of missiles, including an intermediate range supersonic ballistic missile designed to cause maximum damage, and it has.
No, it's not designed to cause maximum damage. It could have, but this is a message. What is this, right? That they're confusingly talking about and can't even pronounce the name of the missile. Talking heads. What Russia did was it fired the Oreshnik missile into Ukraine. It is one of the most potentially devastating missiles in the world today. This missile fired into Ukraine, it was not armed with a nuclear warhead. But it could have been. That's the message. The missile is hypersonic. And according to even Western experts, at places like MIT, air defense systems are not able to stop it. That's not a boast. That's not a brag. That's reality. Here's President Putin talking about it calmly.
The Oreshnik missile is not just an effective hypersonic weapon because of its striking power, especially when used in a massive group. The results of its use against enemy targets will be comparable in their effectiveness with other strategic weapons. There is no defense against such a missile. There is no means of intercepting it in the world today.
By the way, just about 5 minutes ago, we received an update on what the attack did, or what the results of this Oreshnik usage did or was. And here's what we know about the Oreshnik attack. This info is just now being released by Russia's defense ministry. And what they're saying is, they say it took out Ukraine's major fighter jet repair site. That's huge. That's where the American F-16s are based, in Lvov, along with the Lvov region plant as well. Oreshnik strikes also hit various drone production links. And a separate attack with drones and Iskander missiles also has left most of Kyiv without any power, and there's no way that they're going to be able to fix it, at least in the short term. Let that sink in. The Russians did not attack trenches. They didn't attack the troops. In a massive scale, they attacked the civilian energy grid, the backbone of a modern state. This is not a random response. This is not an emotional response. It is a strategic message. Here's retired U.S. Colonel Douglas MacGregor.
I think the Russians still credit us as Americans with more virtue, probably, than we deserve, given the people that govern us. But at this point, it's over. I don't think the Russians are going to pay any attention to us. I don't think the Chinese are going to pay very much attention to anything we say either. Nay, look at what we've done with these oil tankers. Are the Chinese going to go to war with us over it? Are the Russians? No, they're not going to go to war over these vessels. But these things have now fundamentally persuaded these governments and the people that lead them that we're not a trustworthy partner. And so trying to negotiate anything with them in the future is going to be extremely difficult. And there will come a time when we will want their goodwill and we will need to negotiate with them, and it's not going to happen.
The colonel, who, by the way, is also a brilliant military historian, just listen to him talk, he's familiar with Russia's predicament very well. Russia wants to be part of the solution, but it generally isn't allowed to be. It's generally ignored, and it's often lied to as well. So it's now sending a message that cannot be misunderstood. It doesn't raise its voice. It simply shows what it can do. Because for them, this is existential. It's about their survival. And they've been saying this same damn thing for years.
Why would we use a weapon of mass destruction? There has never been such a need. We have our principles. That is, we are prepared to use any weapon if the existence of the Russian state is at stake, or if our sovereignty and independence are undermined.
That's not bluster. That's an unmistakable message that says, keep pushing, go ahead, but know who you're dealing with. Look at our reach. Look at the Oreshnik. Look at our precision. Look at what we're choosing not to do. Not to do. Do not confuse our restraint with weakness. That's what Russia seems to be saying, right? And history tends to agree. Great powers, they don't scream before they act. They signal. They warn. They show you the chessboard, right? One last time. Does the West not see that? Are they just too damn blinded by bankers, by money, by war profiteers, and by their stupid reliance on cable news hosts and Rachel Maddows and cable news cycles? Russia, as far as I can tell, and I'm a Western observer, right? I'm looking at it as a Westerner. As far as I can tell, they don't operate here on a 24-hour news cycle. They don't need daily outrage. They operate on clear red lines. And when those lines involve leadership or crossing into civilian infrastructure or deep strikes into their territory, then it's no longer about politics. It's about survival. Look, what we're witnessing from the West looks like, to me anyway, staggering recklessness. They push Russia as if Russia were incapable of pushing back. They confuse restraint for weakness, and they keep doing it and doing it, treating escalation as if it were a reasonable replacement for diplomacy. It is not. That is why many fear that the next message from Russia will also not come in the form of a soundbite. It will come in a way that everyone will immediately understand. Do they get that? Do the elites in Paris, in London, in Berlin, in Washington understand that? God, I hope so. And that's what we're going to be talking about, as we're joined now by Cameron McGregor. He is an American who founded Free Speech Platform, an entrepreneur, and who talks about finance and geopolitics. And I've had the opportunity of talking to him in the past, and I find him to be brilliant, which is why I'm so glad that he's here with you. Cameron, good to see you, my friend.
Good evening, and thanks for having me on your show, Rick.
It's a pleasure. What do you think of where we are right now and the idea that Russia has shown restraint, but just in the last couple of weeks, it seems to be sending a message that says, here's what we can do, but we don't want to do it. Do you agree that's the message they're sending? And what does it mean?
Yeah, this is a good question, and it's pregnant with answers, to be sure. Well, last year, the Deputy Foreign Minister, Sergei Rybakov, said that U.S.-Russian relations were on the verge of rupturing. I think you might be able to say at this stage that they are rupturing. I just returned from Donbass. I was there a few weeks ago. And what I can tell you is a few things. The first is that this is a major war that's unfolding in Ukraine. And I say that in part because there's a lot of analysts in the West who haven't seen firsthand the carnage, the destruction that I have, that perceive Ukraine as sort of the front in a geopolitical chessboard. That's not what this is. This is a major war that's killing millions of people and threatening to disrupt the lives of tens of millions, particularly if this does not stop now. That's the first takeaway. The second is that Russia has put a massive amount of resources into the reconstruction, the rebuilding of Ukraine. And that demonstrates that this effort in Donbass is rapidly becoming a revitalization project for the Russian state writ large. And thirdly, I would say that there is the very widespread perception, Rick, and this is very dangerous among a lot of the Russian troops that that I was close to, that this war is on the verge of spreading to Western Europe. Now, I certainly hope that that does not occur, but for a lot of the Russians on the front, that's the way they think about it.
Do they think about that because it's coming from the Kremlin, from Russian thought processes, or because they're reacting to some of the threats and some of the boasts from places like I just mentioned, London, Paris, Berlin, et cetera?
It's a good question. Well, I think there's a few things. The first is that there is absolutely the widespread perception that on the other side in Ukraine, operating against them, are Western proxy forces. And I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that is exactly the case. So in their mind, a lot of what's happening is already, to some degree, escalated to the point of war. The second is that there seems to be a failure, certainly in the Russian sense, to understand exactly how they are seen in the West. But they're beginning to conclude that they've been vilified. And I think the Western elites, certainly not the Western population, but the Western elites have vilified them. And so the Russian view is, well, this is a foregone conclusion, so we're going to escalate to the next step. As I said, I don't think it needs to go that way. I think that there are safeguards the Kremlin has put in place, but we're getting dangerously close to a metastasis of this war.
There's something fascinating that's happening, and I think it's only developed in the past week or so, this discussion about Trump going beyond Venezuela and now moving on to Greenland, which for the first time is making people talk about the fact that if he does that, it'll be the destruction of NATO, the destruction of the EU. Oh, my, right? It's interesting that that's happening at the same time that the Russians are feeling like the Americans are kind of leaving them out on the lurch. This whole idea that suddenly the Europeans are feeling a little bit of the same thing they've never given a crap about when anybody else feels it seems almost, if not obnoxious, certainly ironic, doesn't it?
Absolutely. What I would say is that I think if you look at the track record, certainly of the Trump administration over the past year, basically what Donald Trump has done is he has graduated or denigrated, depending on how you want to look at it, the United States from being an unreliable partner, which it certainly was in the Biden administration, to an outright rogue state. And so from the vantage point of the global South and certainly the Russians, they don't know what to make of exactly what's happening in the United States. Mm-hmm. What I would say, and what I've tried to relay to a lot of these folks, is that what drives everything externally in the U.S. is what's happening internally. And internally, things in the U.S. are a mess. In fact, I was looking at some economic metrics earlier before I came on the program. From 1990 until today, the stock market by market capitalization has grown about 300%. Corporate profits in the same time frame have grown by 200%. But per capita wages in the United States adjusted for inflation, well, they have fallen by 20%. The president of the United States was elected specifically to address that economic inequality and that problem. He has lost the plot. And more importantly, his agenda domestically is very muddled. And so what seems to be happening is he's turning his attention externally in some very confusing and dangerous ways to compensate for a loss of control domestically. That's what I see.
But he would tell you if he were a part of this conversation, and he's welcome to join us, by the way, in case he's getting a chance to watch this or somebody at the CIA sends him this. He would tell you, Cameron, yeah, but everything that you just mentioned, including the $38 trillion that we owe, I'm going to fix that. That's why I'm doing what I just did in Venezuela. That's why I'm doing the tariffs, et cetera. What would you say to that if the president raised that argument, which, by the way, he raises daily. He's been bragging about how this is a game changer. The U.S. economy is now going to improve because of what we just did in Venezuela, because we're going to have, his words, 55% of the world's oil.
Yes. Well, when it comes to President Trump, as I think the world is learning, and I certainly hope the American people are paying attention, the devil's always in the details now, isn't it, Rick? With him, it's less so the intention, per se, at least what he expresses verbally, and it's a large measure of failure of execution. Let's talk about Venezuela for just a moment. You're right to point out that in Latin America, the United States has an infamous record of intervening all over the region. And to my mind, that has produced feverish anti-Americanism all over the region, to include Venezuela. The president tells us that we have liberated Venezuela. The president tells us that we have operational control of the country. The president tells us that we have access to the oil. I don't believe any of those things are true. In fact, I think we're sort of without a plan, operating offshore in the hopes that we can bargain our way into some kind of a better geopolitical position. I would say doubly so in Ukraine. The president was elected, and he said repeatedly that he would end the war in Ukraine with a phone call. Well, it seems as though at this stage that his policies towards the Russians are more or less the same as the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. So we are stuck in a diplomatic quagmire with no direction forward. And domestically, as I said, his agenda is all but stalled out. His poll numbers are falling. The American First voting bloc that supported him, that got him elected, they are increasingly turning against the president. And as I said, Rick, I think what's happening is he's lashing out as a result because he's losing momentum.
Well, it's funny because, you know, you're so smart to point this out. In many ways, he said that he was going to be America First, but instead he's been just the opposite of America First. It seems to me that all of the decisions are based on foreign policy and what needs to be done in other countries or for other countries, i.e. Israel. While at the same time, he's saying that he's doing those things to fix the internal economy of the United States. It doesn't seem to me that the American people are going to buy that argument, because it flies in the face of everything he campaigned on, correct?
Look, the president was elected for three reasons, and I can be very crystal clear on this. The first was to de-escalate and disengage from forever wars. Well, as we previously discussed and you detailed in your monologue, that pillar has absolutely failed to materialize for all kinds of reasons, not the least of which is I think the president has capitulated to special interests. I think that goes without question. The second is that he was elected to retrench the United States government fiscally. If you recall, there was a man named Elon Musk who has a giant platform called Twitter and a lot of big companies. He was brought in specifically to reorganize the government to get it on a fiscally solvent track. He lasted less than 6 months and he was removed, and our deficits are exploding just as every previous administration. So there has been no fiscal retrenchment. And thirdly, he was elected to reindustrialize the United States. Now, his weapon of choice to do this, as you know, was to sort of bully the world through tariffs and or sanctions. I think the track record so far demonstrates that that approach has egregiously failed. So what is the president to do? I mean, this is the conundrum that he's in. He needs a publicity stunt is the way he thinks about it. And I think that's what Venezuela is. I think that's what Greenland is. Essentially, he tries to create publicity stunts to distract the American people from the fact of the matter, which is that his administration is losing airspeed and altitude.
Do you think it's possible? I was just thinking as you were saying that, that there's a possibility. There's some arguments out there, and I don't know what the direct number is, but somewhere between, he's made somewhere between $300 million to $3 billion already since he has been in office. And some of it was guarantees that he got while he was running for office. Do you think he's just so compromised that that's the real reason he's doing all the things that he is doing, that it has less to do with the welfare of Americans like you and me and more to do with promises made to others that need to be kept, others who put money in his pocket?
You know, this might be the million-dollar question, and certainly I do not know if the president is compromised. I will say a couple things, though. One is, I think in order for him to become president again in 2024, he almost certainly made a deal of some kind with the donor class, and specifically with Miriam Adelson. Mm-hmm. Now, as to the tenets of that deal, I'm sure I don't know, but I think that at least a major part of it was some kind of an escalation against Iran on behalf of Israel. In other words, a capitulation to the Zionist lobby. I think it is also worth noting that there were none of the kind of election irregularities or the tomfoolery that we saw in the 2020 election on Election Day in 2024. Mysteriously, everything went smoothly, and all of a sudden, he was elected in short order. That suggests to me that he made a lot of capitulations. Now, in addition to the Zionist lobby, what a lot of Americans are paying attention to is what's happening domestically. Domestically, I think Wall Street is writing a lot of his legislation. In other words, he's granting access to private equity so that 401k owners can get exposure to the shadow banking system. That doesn't represent the MAGA movement. That represents Wall Street. I think to a large extent, his administration has simply sold out. They've sold out to Wall Street. They've sold out to Silicon Valley. They've sold out to the special interests. And now what we're seeing is a marketing campaign to convince us that that is not the case when, in fact, it is.
Is that why Tulsi Gabbard is an unknown entity in the White House these days? Is that why, as you mentioned, Elon Musk is kind of a persona non grata as well? And instead, we see Ratcliffe and Marco Rubio and these people who have been essentially primed and readied for these positions by either neocons or, let me just say, call it what it is, the government of Israel.
Well, Rick, I'm sure I don't have to tell you that when it comes to the United States government, there's a much bigger ancillary, unofficial cottage industry, if you will, of perpetual status quo thinkers, right? You might call them globalists, you might call them bureaucrats, maybe you'd call them big government evangelists. Whatever the case may be, whether you're talking about the nonprofit industry, you're talking about the Foreign Service School at Georgetown, you're talking about the university system, all of this is a funnel for the same kind of thinking. And what do these people think? They're Russophobes, right? They think that, that Putin is a totalitarian dictator who threatens global peace. They would say the same thing about China. What do they think domestically? They think that Wall Street and Silicon Valley should dictate economic distribution of power in the United States. These are the same people, Rick, that have staffed Donald Trump's government with very few exceptions, Tulsi Gabbard being one of them. So the way to think about it is Donald Trump is sort of sitting in a board meeting, and he's at the head of the table, and around him are 10, 11, or 12 voices that are all expressing the same opinion. In other words, there's no cognitive diversity whatsoever. And the one or two voices that may disagree, well, they're marginalized and isolated every bit as much as Tulsi Gabbard has. Essentially, they're told to sit down and color. That is why you get no change. And remember that the premise of the Trump election both times was that you could essentially elect your way into a transformative government. But if you looked at the details of who staffed Donald Trump's administration both times, it was the same customers, and that meant no change, and that's where we are.
And so there are no transformative figures in this government, though. That's what's, you know, the promise that was sold to us by Elon Musk, by Tulsi Gabbard, by Tucker Carlson, by, you know, Douglas McGregor, by all these people who made us think that their way of thinking, which I think is the right way of thinking, was going to either predominate or at least be heard during this administration. It's bullcrap. None of those people are in the administration anymore, and none of that thinking seems to even exist, at least not in terms of the actions or the things that are going on, right?
Look, we're on the precipice of a very dangerous moment in the Western world. The democratic system as structured is breaking down, and it's breaking down for the reasons that we've described. The elites, whether you're talking about in the European Union, in Western Europe, they fall under the umbrella of a sort of globalist bureaucracy that blocks any change regardless of what happens at the ballot box. The same thing exists in the United States with the Uniparty. And what that has done is it's collapsed trust. It has broken the social contract. And that's why if you look at the polling data, virtually to a country, whether you're talking about Western Europe or the United States or Canada, the public at large no longer believes in the democratic process. They no longer believe that they can vote their way out of this problem. Mm. And so what are the elites doing? Well, essentially, because they have provoked such animus domestically, they're turning their attention overseas. They're turning their attention to the villains as they've concocted them in Ukraine, in East Asia, maybe with Iran in the Middle East. This is a situation that could rapidly spiral out of control if we do not get elite turnover in the Western world. That is what we must get.
Speaking of elites, let's go back to Greenland for a minute, because I think that's a fascinating conversation. The irony of this all of a sudden, that obviously anybody with half a brain knows that what the U.S. just did in Venezuela is crazy. You don't kidnap a standing leader of a country. You just don't do that. It's a horrible precedent to set. Just as many of the things that, you know, this administration has done or promises to do. And if, in fact, the next target is Iran, I think that, too, would be crazy. And I think we would only be doing it at the request of Israel, right? So that's on the table. But suddenly this Greenland thing gets interesting, because if this Greenland thing actually happens, they say that Mr. Trump has already told his advisors to put together a Greenland plan for him. If this happens, what it does is it actually creates almost a collapse or a huge conflagration within Europe. So it hurts NATO. It hurts the EU. I'm all for that. Sorry for saying that. But, I mean, I think those people are the global elitist bankers who are running the world or trying to. Obviously, I'm not proposing here that it's a good idea for the United States to take over Greenland. It just seems funny that one of the end results of that would also be that the elitist globalist Europeans would kind of be screwed in all of this as well.
Look, the president of the United States is under a lot of pressure. He's obviously an aging president. I mean, I think he's flirting with 80 years of age. As I said, domestically, he's losing support.
Yeah.
And he seems to get distracted in these sort of marginal skirmishes that don't have much geopolitical weight. This event in Greenland certainly doesn't. He has lost the plot, in other words. And I do wonder about his health. I do wonder about the pressure that's being brought on him, sort of weighing the man down. Because what I do not see, Rick, is some kind of geopolitical four-dimensional chess. This is the argument that you hear in the United States, is that we've got to trust the plan, that really beneath the surface, there's some overarching strategy.
Yeah.
That is not what I see. What I see is an old man who's flailing about and really doesn't know what the hell he's doing. We could see the 25th Amendment in the United States triggered. I think something of that nature could happen, particularly if this escalation against Iran occurs. And I think that that is imminent. I really do. I think that's why this latest trip of Benjamin Netanyahu's to Mar-a-Lago occurred. I think we are gearing up for the main event in Iran, while these other fires, the fire in Ukraine, the fire in Venezuela, the fire in Greenland, all of these things are sort of conflagrations that could all converge together. And the president does not appear to understand, number one, the limits of his power, the limits of the United States. As you say, you cannot simply go into a country, whether it's Venezuela or any country, your hemisphere or otherwise, and violate so flagrantly international norms without consequences. He does not appear to understand that. Secondly, he does not appear to understand the rapid deterioration of the United States economy and its financial system. And that ultimately could sink him. So he's lost the plot. He's definitely flailing. And I do not see a plan. What I see is a president, sort of like the Federal Reserve itself in the U.S., losing control of interest rates, losing control of border policy, losing control of national strategy.
But here's the problem, right? You're right. And I think everything you just said is right on the money. And most people, most thinking people around the world would agree with you. But here's the problem. All the crazy things that he's doing are things that a lot of the real people who run the United States, your country, my country, which you and I grew up as little kids thinking we elected people and they're the guys that have the power or the gals who have the power. No, they don't. If there's anything I've come to realize now as I've seen the world from a broader perspective is that the people who run the United States are not the people we elect. They're the people above the people we elect. And those people probably love what this crazy guy is doing. They think it's great that we're going to invade Iran. They think it's great that we stole, that we want to steal Venezuela's money, et cetera. So I guess I'm pushing back on you on the idea that somehow there will be a force within the United States that will be able to stop this. Is there? Can there be? Who? How? When?
The United States, like any other country in the world, is ultimately premised on a social contract. And that social contract requires, at a minimum, three things. You got to protect the population, you got to feed the population, you got to shelter the population. Mm. Never mind, you have to maintain a sharp delineation between a citizen and a non-citizen. What's happening in the United States today, Rick, is something like the Great Depression. It is truly that bad on that scale. I mean, you have tens of millions of Americans who are living paycheck to paycheck,
yeah,
who are borrowing just to make ends meet, who can't afford to pay for food, right? Who are practicing buy now, pay later, because otherwise they can't buy the food or the groceries that they need to make it through the week. The situation, in other words, is very explosive. Never mind the fragmentation that you have in the United States, racially, culturally, religiously, and then, of course, superimposed on that is flagrant government corruption and inefficiency. Now, back to something else that you said a moment ago. There's no question that special elites are driving a lot of what's happening in Washington, D.C. However, remember that a lot of these special interests, whether you're talking about Wall Street, you're talking about the neocons, the Zionists, etc., they have divergent interests. They don't necessarily overlap. And what that means is you get a sort of policymaking like you're seeing from Donald Trump. It's erratic. It's haphazard. He's being pulled towards Venezuela. Then he's pulled towards Iran. All of this is happening essentially because you have different factions within the government that are pulling and contorting our policy in different directions. Donald Trump was supposed to be the steady hand of leadership that would stay our country on course. He has lost the plot. He's lost control. That's what's really happening. But violating that social contract in the manner that he has, and frankly speaking, in the manner that a lot of presidents have going back 50 years, it's all now beginning to come to a head. Mm. And when that social contract sort of implodes economically, you're going to see major recourse, a major reconstruction. What's the timeline for this? I'm sure I can't say. Mm. But what I can say is I do think that the institutions of power in the West are losing control of the situation, whether that's interest rates in the bond market, whether that's a sort of escalatory ladder in Ukraine, or it's the breakdown of regional stability in the Middle East. In each case, through their own hands, I might add, they are on a self-destructive course, and I think things are accelerating. I don't think there's any reverse gear.
Hmm. You know, final question, because I know you've thought about this. You and I talked about this when we got together last time and had this conversation, and it's what you just explained, perilousness of the economic situation in the United States, but it goes beyond the United States, right? Because if what you just said happens, then we also have a U.S. dollar that deflates, a currency that doesn't work and has to be replaced. We have a banking system that isn't trusted because people don't want to trust it for fear that what happened to Venezuela's gold in the Bank of London will happen to their gold, or what happened to Russia's $250 billion will also happen to them. So there seems to be this thing, and I've heard you talk about this, the word you usually use is the weaponization of America's assets, right? What we've done since World War II. What happens? Draw me that picture. What happens if all those things break down? What happens to the United States? What course does the world take? And is that already kind of in the works, you think, Cameron?
So there is absolutely no question that the monetary balance of power in the world, the economic balance of power in the world, has shifted from west to east. And sadly speaking, that has been engineered largely by Wall Street, largely by the financialization of our economy. And this certainly you could bookmark 1971 and exiting the gold standard as a beginning of that process. But the fact of the matter is that I would say in the 1960s, we had an elite turnover in the Western world. And this elite turnover has a basic consensus. And that consensus was that the interests of the nation, the interests of Americans, the interests of Germans and Poles and Czechs and Hungarians and Frenchmen, that those interests were subordinated to a globalist project, that we now lived in a rules-based order as they defined it. We lived in the garden with their rules, and if you oppose them, you lived in the jungle. Well, what has happened, I would say, over the last 20 years, but it's really started to kick off in the last few years. It began with, I think, the COVID lockdowns, which almost certainly were a death knell for the Western economy. The lockdowns crippled the small businesses that activate a lot of the economic energy in the United States and Western Europe. The special military operation is an expression of a pushback from the global South against the expansionist and aggressive foreign policy of the neocons and the Zionists and so forth. And thirdly is this explosion of inflation across the world. And certainly that has been centered in the United States. But the reaction to this has been to de-dollarize. It has been to divest from the United States. And that is precarious because that means that Americans, for the first time in decades, are experiencing a revaluation of their assets. That means their homes are falling in value, not rising. That means that the cost of living is rising. It's not falling. Mm. That means essentially that the standard of living is not improving. It's getting worse. All that is to say, we are absolutely in the throes of a massive transformation. Now, your question to me is, what is going to trigger this? It could be any number of things. It could be this war in Iran. I think it's going to be a banking crisis because that banking crisis will essentially end trust in the United States financial system. And remember that the U.S. financial system and the U.S. government are basically tied at the hip. And that's been the case since about 2008. So we are experiencing the denouement of an American-dominated international system right before our eyes.
Wow. Cameron McGregor, wow, you are so smart and you are so able to explain these things. And I'm serious. I speak for the tens of millions of people who are watching us right now or will be watching us all over the world. We really appreciate you being able to explain this as well as you have, as you've taken us through this situation. And we hope that sober minds can listen to this and make the correct accommodations. Thank you, my friend. It's really a pleasure to have you on and have this conversation with you. Thanks for being my first guest of the year, by the way. You look great.
Always, Rick. Always a pleasure, Rick. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, as you well know, we get thousands of comments from you on my posts every day. But over the holidays, we've got a lot of stuff because I was writing in Miami and posting myself. And we got a lot of comments regarding the U.S. attack on Venezuela. So here's a sampling. Abu Shiva says, because of betrayal from within, that's how Maduro was easily kidnapped. Engram 9511 says, the fact is, there was no war. Maduro was sold out. Amazing Life says, they, the U.S., have the best military, but they have to resort to treason and bribery? And YouTube, or YouTube, says, try that in Russia or China, if you dare. And finally, Joy says, thank you, Mr. Sanchez, for being the adult in the room. I try. Trust me, when I'm around my kids, I'm less of an adult. As usual, all the feedback is appreciated, and I want to say to you that I'm on YouTube. Check out Journalistically Speaking, and don't hesitate to tell me what you think. Whether you agree with what I'm saying or disagree, it doesn't matter. Also, look for me on X. I go there by Rick Sanchez TV. Tens of thousands live there and have this conversation, and we welcome it. Thank you most of all for letting us into your homes, and we'll be looking for you next time.